Fiona Summers. I'm an MD-MPH student at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York City. And I'm really happy to be here to talk to you about my MPH thesis research, which was conducted with our patient population to get a sense of how teens feel that we can encourage and facilitate disclosure of intimate partner violence during teen pregnancy. So I have no disclosures to make. So as Chen mentioned, when dealing with intimate partner violence, it's very difficult to define the true scope of the problem. It's an issue that many victims and survivors don't really feel comfortable discussing. But what we do know, based on the results of the Community Health Survey and the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, is that at least in New York City, intimate partner violence is about 5 times more common among teenage girls than it is among adult women, at least by self-report. And these are numbers within the past year, which is why they're not as high as Chen's. The lifetime prevalence is obviously higher. But what we see here is that we have 1 in 10 teenage girls reporting that in the last year alone she experienced dating violence. So this is a really serious problem for our patient population. We can also see that the rates of teen dating violence in New York City have been increasing, and that as of the last data available, they'd actually outpaced the national rate. So it's, again, something we're very concerned about. Obviously, as Tim mentioned, there are a lot of, and Rhea as well, there are a lot of health comorbidities associated with intimate partner violence. This data, again, is from the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, and it shows that in almost every indicator listed here, teenage girls fare worse if they've experienced dating violence as compared to their peers who have not. We see that as far as mental health, depression and suicidal ideation and attempts are more common if they've experienced violence. They're more likely to use cigarettes, drugs, and alcohol. And importantly, for purposes of our study, they're more likely to engage in sexual risk behaviors and are more than twice as likely to have been pregnant. At the same time that they have all of these related health problems, they have less access to health care. Community health survey data in New York City shows that women who are afraid of an intimate partner are 3 times as likely to report that they can't access the care that they need. So we have a situation here where women who really need more care are getting less of it. And so it's very important for providers to be aware of the possibility that their patients may be experiencing violence, because it really does affect their health. So that's IPV. As far as teen pregnancy in New York, New York State has the 11th highest rate of teen pregnancy in the country, and the rate in New York City has consistently been higher than the national average. But within the patient population that Mount Sinai sees, which is prominently from the community of East Harlem, the teen pregnancy rate is 90% higher than it is in the rest of New York City. That's all 5 boroughs. So it's a very common issue for our patient population. So bringing this together, if you look at the PRAMS data from the CDC, the self-reported rates of intimate partner violence during teen pregnancy are almost twice as high as they are in any other age group. And there's a huge jump in the rate of violence experienced before pregnancy versus during pregnancy. So it's something that really concerns us. At the same time, this data clearly represents an underestimate, given that we have 1 in 10 girls self-reporting that she's experiencing violence in general. The odds are that the number of pregnant teens experiencing it are much higher than the PRAMS data suggests. And this is a mail-in survey, so many teenage girls are not that likely to give a full an honest response to it. I looked at some other studies from around the country that have suggested that the actual rates of violence during teen pregnancy can range anywhere from 13 to 38%. It's a very common problem. So our study was an exploratory study that we designed to get a sense of how teens in our patient population perceive intimate partner violence, whether they understand the health consequences, and importantly for purposes of today's discussion, how they think that screening can be targeted to make teens feel more comfortable disclosing abuse when they're dealing with their healthcare providers and social workers in the healthcare setting. So we had a convenient sample of 10 former teen and young adult parents who were recruited from Mount Sinai's teen parenting programs. We had them complete a short anonymous survey at the outset to get a sense of demographics and prior knowledge and experiences. And then they participated in single-sex focus groups that discussed vignettes of violence during teen pregnancy, as well as questions about problems and solutions in teen relationships. And then we presented the same vignettes and questions to 4 key informants who are all social workers who work with pregnant and parenting teens to get a sense if their ideas were in line with what the former teen parents were suggesting, and also if they had anything to add. There were two questions discussed in the focus group, specifically dealt with the issue of talking about IPV in the healthcare setting. The first was, how do teens feel about discussing their relationships with a doctor or social worker? And the second was, what kind of messages from a doctor or social worker could help teens to have healthier relationships? Our results, not surprisingly, were that all three groups, the female focus group, male focus group, and key informants, agreed that teens are unlikely to disclose IPV in the healthcare setting. And the reasons that they described tended to cluster around two themes. The first was issues at the individual level, at the level of individual encounters with providers, and the second was problems that are inherent to the system of care. So at the level of the encounter, many of the focus group participants talked about the issue of jargon. They felt that doctors have a tendency to talk over teenagers' heads, and at best that might make the teens feel dumb, at worst it might make them feel a bit condescended to. This quote comes from one of the female focus group participants. And so this tends to be a barrier to good communication within the encounter. There was also a perception across the board that providers tend to approach intimate partner violence with a checklist mentality. When a provider starts the conversation by saying, "I'm so sorry, I just have to ask about violence in your relationship," teens get the sense that the provider doesn't necessarily care about the answer to the question. They're asking because it's their job. So this quote again comes from one of the young women in the focus groups. Unfortunately, the time constraints in the encounter tend to feed into this, but it's difficult for teens to get the impression that the doctor really cares about the answer if they think that they're just doing it because they have to. Then, of course, there's the issue of how providers relate to teens. And all of the groups agreed that sometimes they don't relate that well. As one of the young women states here, there is this perception that they may be judged if they disclose that they've been abused. And it's of a particular concern to teens who are pregnant, because they're very acutely aware of the fact that adults in general, and providers as well, may be skeptical of their parenting skills because of their age. And they're afraid to disclose anything that might further that perception that they're not ready to be a parent. At the same time, they're also aware of the fact that adults are often dismissive of teen relationships and don't necessarily think that anything seriously wrong can happen in a teen relationship, because they may not be living with that person, et cetera. So that's another barrier. Then there's the issue of the fear of losing control. Teens are afraid that if they disclose that somebody's been hurting them, it may get blown out of proportion. One of the concerns always in dealing with any sort of sensitive subject with a teen is whether their parents are going to be told. Interestingly, when we talked to the key informants and some of the focus group participants, they noted that often the parents already are aware that this is happening and are choosing not to do anything about it, either because the parent has herself experienced violence in her relationship and thinks that it's normal, or because the partner may be contributing financially to the household, or because they're afraid of the partner themselves. From the teen's point of view, involving the parents, if that does happen, may not be helpful. They're also obviously afraid of police reports being filed against their will, or of ACS being called and their children being taken away from them. And one thing that came up among the female focus group participants was the fear of being forced to move to an IPV shelter, which is not something that I've ever encountered happening, but it was a real concern that they had. And finally, there was the perception that the information is just too personal to talk to a doctor about. There was definitely a perception that IPV is more of a social issue than a health issue, and they're not sure what a doctor would do about it if the information was shared with a doctor. They think it's more something to be dealt with at the family level, and if it needs to be taken outside of that realm, then at the community level, particularly in schools. But they didn't see the doctor as having a significant role to play. So then at the level of the healthcare system, again, related to the idea of the checklist mentality, there's this problem of time constraints. Obviously, doctors have to see a lot of patients in any given day, and so the encounters can be rushed and may seem a bit impersonal. This quote comes from one of the young men, what he said was pretty representative of what all groups had to say. The rest of the points on this slide come from the key informants, who pointed out that when you're dealing with a teenage population, they tend to be pretty healthy at baseline. They're not necessarily coming to the doctor that often. When you're dealing with pregnant teens, you have a unique opportunity because you are seeing them more often as they come in for their prenatal care. But as we pointed out before, teens who are experiencing violence may actually have a harder time accessing care, and so it's very important to take advantage of the opportunities that you do have to see them. Then there's the issue of disjointed care. At least in New York City, many pregnant teens are on public insurance, and so they're coming to public clinics to get their care. Because of that, they may not be seeing the same doctor at every visit, and so it can be very difficult to build a trusting relationship with one provider when you never know who you're going to see that particular day. This quote comes from one of the social workers. And finally, there was the issue of the vulnerability of the exam room setting. Obviously, exam rooms are fairly clinical and sterile environments that are even less conducive to, you know, a friendly chat when you're you have a patient who's coming in for a gyn exam who's already having her personal space very invaded. It makes it harder to then bring up other personal issues, which may be perceived as even more of an invasion. So the focus groups and the social workers had a number of proposed solutions. The most important one across the board was taking the time to build a trusting therapeutic relationship with one doctor, which obviously, because of the system constraints, may be difficult to do, but they felt it was very important. Then they also talked about how to approach the question to avoid the sort of checklist perception. These questions here were suggested by the female focus group participants, and everybody across the board stated that it's important to try to avoid being too direct in order to avoid coming across as accusatory or like you're making an assumption based on the patient's age or their race. So the young woman suggested starting with a very broad question, like, are you happy? Moving from that to, do you know what abuse is? Because again, many of these girls may have grown up witnessing abuse in their homes, and so they don't necessarily know that what they're experiencing is a problem. So this represents a great opportunity for education. And from there you can move to, do you know anybody who's been abused? This is a broad question that allows them to either, you know, talk about their friends if they want to, but also to talk about what's happening to themselves without having to disclose that, you know, they are in fact the person experiencing the violence. So educating teens obviously is also very important, again, because you need to explain what constitutes abuse. Some of them may not know. It's also important to talk about what the potential consequences are, because many of them don't see this as a health issue and don't recognize that this could have serious implications for themselves or for the health of their baby. And everybody stated that it was important to give concrete facts and examples. Many of the focus group participants gave the impression that they felt that this information is often sugar-coated when it's given to them, and they want that respect, you know, that they can be given the facts like an adult, and so they can make informed decisions. So they felt that was important as well. This quote comes from one of the young men. Equally important is the issue of educating providers. Many providers are not comfortable talking about abuse. It's also important that providers really take the time and make the effort to show concern when they ask these questions. This quote comes from one of the young women, because again, they feel that if the provider is asking just because it's their job and not because they care, it's not really conducive to an honest conversation. The key informants pointed out that it's very important for providers to know the answers to the questions that teens are likely to ask them, because the teen might start to disclose and then get the sense that the provider doesn't actually know what's going to happen to them if they do decide to file a police report, for example, and they may clam up after that. And finally, it's important to avoid making promises that cannot be kept. As with any intimate partner violence situation, it's true for teens as well, that the person experiencing the violence is the person best equipped to know what's really going to happen if she tries to leave her partner. And so it's very important to be very realistic when you're talking about this and helping the teen make decisions. All of the groups felt that it would be very helpful to distribute printed information to all teens who come into the clinic. This avoids singling anybody out, and it also provides alternative mechanisms for disclosure. If the pamphlets include information about how to contact community groups that may be perceived as perhaps a less threatening place to disclose. These pamphlets can also include information about a safety plan, which none of the participants in our groups knew what that was, despite the fact that a number of them had experienced violence in their relationships. And it can provide hotline numbers so that teens know, you know, if in the middle of the night I suddenly have to get out, what do I do? Where do I go? The focus groups also felt that referrals to support groups and peer-to-peer or individual counseling could be very helpful. Granted, we have a biased sample since everybody was recruited from, these were all either current or former participants of support groups, but I guess it's promising that they felt that these were beneficial. they did all think that individual counseling could be helpful, but they were they thought that teens would probably respond best to hearing this information from other teens and young adults who had been in the same situation. Because they are keenly aware that many of the people who tried to educate them about this issue, they know what the book says, but they don't necessarily have that personal experience. So this quote comes from one of the young women. And finally, the key informants pointed out that it's very important to reinforce to the teens that they're not going to lose control of the situation if they disclose. This quote comes from one of the key informants. Teens need to be aware that they're not going to be forced to leave their homes necessarily or forced to file a police report. That said, you do have to be honest with them up front about the situations in which you are a mandated reporter. So in conclusion, teen pregnancy is a very common issue in East Harlem, and pregnant teens are at a high risk for intimate partner violence. And while the structure of the healthcare system is not necessarily conducive to encouraging disclosure, there are definitely steps that individual providers and clinics can take to help teens feel more comfortable either disclosing an abuse or at least starting that conversation so that they can learn more about how to help themselves. Some of the next steps that we're considering include targeted interventions to educate providers and staff who work with pregnant teens about how to approach this issue, making printed resources more ubiquitous in the clinic setting, and promoting referral of at-risk teens to support groups or counseling. We're hoping to collaborate with schools and community organizations to try to strengthen their prevention education and resources, and also to potentially in the future do a larger scale survey of teen experiences by PD and their opinions about interventions that would work in our specific patient population. We may also want to try reviewing the IPD screening practices that are occurring in our clinic settings. So, references and open it up. Thank you.